Universe at Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump has fired the acting U.S. Attorney General after she directed Justice Department officials to not defend his executive order enforcing a temporary restriction on people entering the U.S. from seven countries. The Senate has yet to confirm Mr. Trump's nominee for Attorney General, Senator Jeff Sessions. The White House Monday continued defending the temporary travel ban despite a global protest. Sean Spicer is the president's spokesman.
The president's going to be very proactive with protecting this country. We're not going to wait till we get attacked and figure out how we can make sure it doesn't happen again. He's going to do everything in his power to stop every threat that we face in this country and every potential threat. And that's the key point in this. How do we get ahead of threats? How do we keep America ahead of the curve when it comes to people who want to do us harm?
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer took part in an anti-ban rally on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court.
It will make us unsafe because it makes our soldiers who are fighting overseas have fewer allies. And it will make us unsafe because the nations of the world will no longer look up to us.
The executive order blocks citizens of Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia from entering U.S. territory for a period of 3 months. The ban has been clarified, allowing people from those seven countries with green cards, lawful permanent residency, as well as non-citizen visa holders, to be no longer automatically blocked from entering the U.S. African Union leaders meeting in Ethiopia Monday selected Chad's Foreign Minister Moussa Faki Mohamed to chair the 54-nation continental body. Meanwhile, the AU voted to allow Morocco back in after a 33-year absence. Rabat left in 1984 after the EU admitted the Western Sahara as a separate member. This is VOA News. Police in Quebec City said one suspect is in custody following Sunday's deadly shooting at a mosque that left six dead in what Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called Monday a terrorist attack.
It was an attack on our most intrinsic and cherished values as Canadians, values of openness, diversity, and freedom of religion.
The suspect, 24-year-old Alexander Bissonnette, a student at Laval University, has been charged with six counts of murder, five counts of attempted murder with a restricted weapon. Five people remain in critical condition. A dozen suffered lesser wounds. The U.S. confirmed Monday that Iran test-fired a medium-range ballistic missile that one U.S. official said exploded about 1,000 kilometers from its launch site. The White House said it's aware of the launch and is looking into it. Indiana University Iran analyst Hussein Ben-Ai was asked if the launch violates U.N. Security Council sanctions.
Strictly speaking, no. Although it is a violation of the spirit of the resolution passed just prior to the signing of the nuclear agreement between Iran and the P5+1 that basically prohibited Iran from carrying out any testing of missiles that would be capable of carrying a nuclear warhead.
A top Senate Republican condemned the launch, saying he would work with other U.S. lawmakers and the White House to hold Tehran accountable. Houthi rebels Monday attacked a Saudi frigate with three boats off the western coast of Yemen, causing an explosion that killed two sailors and wounded three. One of the boats rammed the Saudi vessel. Malaysian authorities have expanded the search for Chinese tourists and a Malaysian crew member still missing in waters off Borneo Island after their catamaran sank late Saturday in rough seas, tossing 30 people overboard. One of the survivors, Zhang Yaoru, said after the ship capsized, the passengers clung together, making themselves conspicuous for rescuers. The survivors spent several hours in the water before being rescued by local fishermen. The U.S. Senate is pressing on with President Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State with a procedural vote that puts the confirmation on track this week. In a vote of 56-43, Rex Tillerson received the backing of a majority of the Republican-led chamber late Monday. Former U.S. President George H.W. Bush was discharged Monday from a Houston, Texas hospital where he was treated for more than 2 weeks for pneumonia. The 92-year-old ex-president, a World War II Navy pilot, was admitted January 14th after experiencing shortness of breath. U.S. stocks fell Monday on concern among some investors about the uncertainty surrounding the temporary travel ban on people from seven countries entering the United States. The benchmark Dow Jones Index fell more than 100 points to 19,971. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union Commission has a new chairperson.
Moussa Faki Mohamed certainly is a man of experience, and he comes from a country that in recent years has played a very important role in security in the central part of Africa, both in the Sahel region.
J. Peter Pham is the Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Washington-based Africa Center. The African Union expresses concern about U.S. President Donald Trump's immigration ban, and in Nigeria, a church collapse commission has completed its work.
I just hope that whatever the commission sees and discover from this inquiry would be used to the letter in a way that would give victims of the collapsed church building some sense of justice.
One of the residents of Uyo City in Nigeria's Akwa Ibom state, and pressure mounts in Malawi to amend a provision of that country's constitution that allows 16-year-old girls to marry. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. African leaders meeting in Ethiopia on Monday chose Chad's Foreign Minister Moussa Faki Mohamed as the new chairperson of the African Union Commission. He succeeds Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma of South Africa. Moussa Faki defeated four other candidates from Kenya, Botswana, Equatorial Guinea, and Senegal. Moussa Faki once said he dreams of an Africa where the sounds of guns will be drowned out by cultural sounds and rumbling of factories. J.P. DeFarm is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Washington-based Africa Center. He says Moussa Faki is a man of experience, having come from a country that has played a major role in bringing about security in the turbulent central part of Africa. But Pham said one of Moussa Faki's immediate challenges is his lack of international profile outside of Africa.
Moussa Faki Mohamed certainly is a man of experience, and he comes from a country that in recent years has played a very important role in security in the central part of Africa, both in the Sahel region with the assistance it's given to operations against extremists in the Sahel, especially Mali, as well as in the Central African Republic. So he's no stranger to some of the challenges that Africa faces. I think one of the challenges, however, as he enters office is unlike his immediate predecessors, he does not have a very high international profile outside of those who know Africa well.
He said that he would like to silence the guns in Africa and replace them with the sounds of African songs. Is that possible?
Well, it's certainly something that we all should support him in doing. But in order to do that, it's not enough to have nice words. One also has to have, you know, some diplomatic weight. And although he certainly has experience and is well known to Africans, I don't think he has the international profile that his predecessors have had. If you look at the who have been chairpersons of the African Union Commission, from Chairperson Konare to Chairperson Ping to Chairperson Dlamini Zuma, they're people who have had international stature and are well known to the global community outside of those who follow Africa. So I think that's going to be a challenge. I'm not saying he's a very capable person, and he certainly enjoys the support of a strong majority of African states. I'm just stating the obvious challenges that he faces.
Now, why do you think candidates from, say, Kenya, Botswana, Equatorial Guinea, and Senegal, why did they not make it?
Well, I think a number of reasons, too. And with all respect to the other candidates who are on, with the exception of Kenya's Foreign Secretary Amina Mohamed, the other candidates were not as well known. To be quite honest, Botswana's foreign minister and Equatorial Guinea's candidate are hardly well-known figures even in Africa.
Now, you have been following Morocco and the situation with the African Union, but the African leaders readmitted Morocco. Your own reaction, please.
Well, two things. One, Morocco's return to the African institutional family rights a great historic wrong. And so I'm very pleased to see it, not only because it rights that wrong, but it also strengthens Africa as a whole. First, the wrong. The admission of the so-called Sharawi Arab Democratic Republic, which today is not even recognized by a majority of African Union members, was itself irregular. But unfortunately, Morocco, that forced Morocco to leave more than three decades ago. And the African Union without Morocco, quite frankly, is weaker. And so Morocco returning, given Morocco's importance as a anchor of stability for all of Africa, the second largest African investor in Africa after South Africa, a contributor to various operations from peacekeeping to countering violent extremism to propagating moderate forms of Islam to African investments in Africa. These are all things that strengthen the African family as a whole. So I think Morocco's return is very much something to be welcomed.
Before I let you go, Mr. Pham, what's your take on the West African leaders and their action in the Gambia?
I applaud ECOWAS for living up to its charter that they would not accept unconstitutional changes of government or unconstitutional, and that includes holding on to power when you've lost an election, that they carried through. So it's a very good day, not just for West Africa, but for Africa as a whole, that African countries came together and acted decisively.
J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Washington-based Africa Center. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. African nations targeted by the new U.S. immigration ban expressed disappointment in the decision to temporarily ban their nationals from entering the United States. The White House says the ban is needed while immigration policy is being reviewed to improve national security. As viewers Anita Powell reports from the African Union Summit in Addis Ababa, the top diplomat in Africa says the new measure is a sign of turbulent times.
The outgoing head of the African Union Commission, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, says the new American immigration ban not only affects Libya, Somalia, and Sudan, but all African nations.
Excellencies, it is clear that globally we are entering very turbulent times. The very country to whom our people were taken as slaves during the transatlantic slave trade have now decided to ban refugees from some of our countries. What do we do about this? Indeed, this is one of the greatest challenges to our unity and solidarity.
She spoke before dozens of African leaders Monday at the opening of the African Union Summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The African Union says Chad's foreign minister, Moussa Faki Mahamat, will succeed Dlamini-Zuma, whose term in office has expired. The United States already has complicated, sometimes strained relations with the three African countries named in the immigration ban. The U.S. government does not maintain an embassy in either Libya or Somalia, largely because of security concerns. Somalia's foreign minister, Abdi Salam Omar, told VOA his government remains optimistic about its U.S. relations, but the ban is worrying.
We are always sorry to see that people from particularly places where war is being raged now, who are running for their safety, to be told they could not come to the most powerful country in the world, a country that's built on refugees and asylum seekers and people who are running from droughts and persecution and wars and all that. But equally important is that one needs to think about international terrorism and how to defeat it. And we need all to come together, not to discriminate against each other.
Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal told VOA's English to Africa service he sees no reason for Sudan to be among those listed as a state sponsor of terror. That label was affixed in 1993 amid concerns about Sudan's links to Hamas, Hezbollah, and al-Qaeda. But he says Sudan has ramped up its counterterrorism efforts. Bilal says he thinks the order will make America almost isolated from the world. Nations that do not have formal relations with the United States, like the disputed Western Sahara territory that claims independence from Morocco, says this affects them too. That region's ambassador at large, Sidi Omar, told VOA the ban is alarming.
I understand that it is being presented as a measure to counter terrorism and violent extremism and so on and so forth, but I'm afraid that the extremist elements may actually benefit out of this and presenting it as something that anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim, which will feed into their rhetoric that the West is against Islam and so on and so forth.
New UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also spoke at the summit, praising African leaders for accepting refugees and urged African nations to remain open to those seeking shelter and safety. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 31st, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Activist groups in Guinea will today, Tuesday, publicly address what they say are injustices done to the residents of Area 1 in the Guinea-Tinian area of the country. The groups, along with Ghana-based advocates for community alternatives, say that in late 2015, the Guinean government sent a large contingency of security forces to the region under the pretext of clearing out illegal foreign miners. Instead, they used their power to suppress resistance to relocation proceedings that were being carried out by AngloGold Ashanti, a company that is mining the area for gold. Jonathan Kaufman is Executive Director of Advocates for Community Alternatives. He tells Reiki Shryak that most of the contracts signed by residents to relocate were made under duress and that they are calling on action to be taken by the government.
What's happened to the people of Area 1 in Kintinyang is that they have been intimidated and in some cases actually been subject to physical violence that has led them to go along with a relocation from their homes in a process that's been completely confusing to them, in which they've been provided inadequate compensation, in many cases no compensation, and been pressured to move into relocation houses in a site that's not convenient for them, is far from their livelihoods, and has homes that are not completed and have substandard conditions.
When we say they were intimidated, sometimes violence was used. Was it by Guinean security forces? Was it by local government, like the prefecture?
The actual direct intimidation and violence was Guinean security forces. The community had been divided as to how they would react to AngloGold's desire to take the land. And in fact, AngloGold had signed an agreement for relocation with some people claiming to represent the community, although it has never been shown, and the people of Area 1 itself claim that the people who signed this agreement don't even live in Area 1 and never represented them. As a result, there were protests, and originally a group of elders and respected people from Area 1 went to Sigiri, which is the prefectural capital, to meet with the prefect to talk about their concerns and the terms under which they'd be willing to relocate. And rather than listening to them, the prefect arrested them and kept them in jail for several days.
With the relocations already happening, has the mining begun? What stage is this at? What do you hope your press conference will accomplish? Is there any way to reverse this?
People were evicted from their homes for the most part in June, and those homes have all been destroyed, I think maybe with the exception of one or two. Most people have been living in temporary housing, just finding a place to crash essentially, since then. The company has been building homes at a relocation site, but there have been a lot of objections to the state of those homes. Most of them were built without kitchens or bathrooms or enough land for people to have gardens. There are concerns about drainage. So there is still a fair amount of room to improve the situation for the residents of Area 1, partially through improving the compensation and transitional assistance package, partially by improving the relocation homes themselves. But the truth also is, from our analysis, because these contracts that they signed to move out of their homes were not signed freely. They were signed under duress, and in many cases, the people had no idea what they were signing because no one explained it to them, and the contracts were written in French, and most people can't read French. Those agreements aren't actually legally valid. What that could potentially mean, I'm not a Guinean lawyer, but it could mean that people could want to repossess their land. They could potentially take the company to court and try to fix the situation that way.
That was Jonathan Kaufman, Executive Director of Advocates for Community Alternatives. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Accra, Ghana. In December last year, Reynolds Bible Church International in Oyo, Akwa Ibom State in Nigeria, collapsed, killing scores of people. The tragedy led to the establishment of a commission of inquiry, which has ended public hearings and is now working on a final report. Investigators have found that there were claims and counterclaims between the Oyo Capital City Development Authority and the church founder, Akan Weeks, over securing approval for the building. Reporter Dixon Salami Adama has the story.
The commission, which was set up by Governor of the State, Udom Emmanuel, has also been tasked to effectively resolve the varied disputes arising from the tragedy which occurred during the bishopric ordination of the church founder, Apostle Akan Weeks. Chairman of the commission, Justice Umokoyo Esang, retired, at the inaugural sitting called for memorandum from members of the public, saying that they will rely on undisputable evidence made available to them by reputable associations, experts, and individuals with useful information. In his remarks, the State Attorney General and Commissioner for Justice, Uemedimu Woku, urged members of the commission not to leave any stone unturned in justifying the reason that the commission was set up. He said the setting up of the commission came at a critical time in the history of the state, stressing that they must come up with a report that would serve as a valuable guide to both the government and the public in order to forestall future occurrence of such events. However, the first task undertaken by the commission was to order the State Commissioner of Police to release Mr. Anieti Augustine, the architect who was said to have overseen the church construction. The state government had immediately ordered Augustine's arrest after the incident. Counsel to Augustine, Mr. Ekanem, said his client's release would expose many hidden facts on the church collapse, adding that he was being detained unjustly for merely assisting in supervising what was already planned, drawn, and designed, but that there was more to what led to the collapse. Meanwhile, the Uyo Capital City Development Authority accused Apostle Weeks of not securing approval for the building of the church. The authority said that the church building had been marked for demolition 5 times because of the land on which the church was erected had been declared as Forest Reserve Area by the state government through a newspaper report of Weekend Pioneer of October 20, 2000. But the apostle had denied any wrongdoing, saying that he duly applied for the land and also paid the sum of 300,000 naira in the process. The chairman of Akwa Ibom State Correspondent Chapel of the Nigerian Union of Journalists, Dennis Udoma, who led the team of journalists to monitor the public hearing, spoke on the issue.
The expectation is that the commission will come out with a white paper that will be able to fashion out blames on whoever is culpable, either Akan Weeks, the founder of the church, or even those people that were involved in various stages of construction of the church. Aside from that, we are expecting that government should contribute to the burial and even the upkeep of those who had some serious injuries during the accident.
A resident of Uyo, Mrs. Ashimari Idongesi, who witnessed the tragedy, bears her mind on the people's expectation at the end of the commission's work.
I pray that this would not be one of those jamborees usually put up by the state government to appear to be working. I just hope that whatever the commission sees and discover from this inquiry would be used to the letter in a way that would give victims of the collapsed church building some sense of justice. We do hope that justice will be done to serve as deterrent to others so that whenever we want to embark on a project, everything we do must be approved by appropriate quarters to avoid setting traps that will take people's life just like that.
So, as the Commission of Inquiry is winding down its work in order to bring out its final report, there are high expectations from the members of the public, especially the families of those who lost their loved ones. For VOA, this is Dixon Salami Adama, reporting from Uyo, South Nigeria.
In Malawi, pressure is mounting for government to amend a provision of the constitution that allows 16-year-old girls to marry with parental consent. Girls' rights groups say the provision is in conflict with the country's revised marriage law, which raised the legal age of marriage for girls to 18. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi passed the Marriage, Divorce and Family Relations Bill in 2015 to replace a widely criticized old law which allowed 15-year-old girls to marry with the parental consent. Under the new legislation, anyone who marries a girl younger than 18 will serve a minimum jail sentence of 10 years. However, Section 22 of the Malawi Constitution contradicts this. It stipulates that young people between 15 and 18 may marry upon parental consent. Parliament is expected to debate changing the constitution. Until then, parents can challenge the new law with that raised the voting age for marriage. Joyce Nkandawire is the country director for the US-based NGO Let Girls Lead. She told VOA that marrying a girl at 16 is not realistic, and some girls may later blame their parents for encouraging or allowing them to have husbands at such an early age.
The mind is not fully grown. Think about this girl. She's having problems in marriage, and she's now reminiscing. What will she say? She may not say to the parents, but she will die thinking that it wasn't me, but it was my mother.
She says Malawi should embrace the internationally recognized marriage age of 18, although she would opt for more than that.
If we were given like an option to discuss about the age, we would have said 21. But if, I mean, we followed the international law of 18.
Traditional leaders are already ahead of it all. Many of them have enacted bylaws in their communities that allow girls to marry at the age of 21. Treza Kachindamoto is the traditional leader in the district of Central Malawi. She says here we are considering 8 years of primary education, 4 years of secondary education, and another 4 years of tertiary education, and there is also 1 year for internship. She says in this case, at 18 years, the girl will still be in school. She says she feels at 21 years, the girl will be through with her education. She says early marriages also lead to complications at birth and also put the girls at risk of developing fistula. Statistics show that one in two girls marry before the age of 18, one of the highest rates of child marriage in the world. Jessica Bwira is the chairperson of the Women's Caucus in Parliament.
We are very grateful that the traditional leaders want people to get married at that age. But we are also cognizant of the fact that we must not pass a law that we cannot implement. Once you make a law, then what you are saying is anybody at 20, at 19, who gets married will be arrested. Then you better be able to implement that, and you better be able to give enough facilities, which at this moment is really not realistic.
Kabwira, who is also a parliamentarian, says the bill has already been drafted to raise the marriage age to 18 in the Malawi Constitution to match the revised marriage legislation. She says the review is expected to take place in the next sitting of Parliament, probably next month. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Briefly before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. African leaders meeting in Ethiopia on Monday chose Chad's Foreign Minister Moussa Faki Mahamat as the new chairperson of the African Union Commission. He succeeds Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma of South Africa. J.P. de Farm, Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Washington-based Africa Center, says Moussa Faki is a man of experience, having come from a country that has played a major role in bringing about security in the turbulent central part of Africa. But Farm says one of Moussa Faki's media challenges is his lack of international profile outside of Africa. That is it for this Tuesday, January 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very, very nice day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Barty here to remind you that February is Black History Month here in the United States. And starting Wednesday, February 1st, and continuing throughout the month, we will begin our Black History Month and daily quiz series on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African Americans and African individuals and events. Send us your country's historical moment in February. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your